Jane, reel 5.
Were there any periods during which you were doing this kind of work when there were particular shortages which caused particular problems?
Well, there was always shortages of food. I mean, we never had fresh meat. Bully beef was a luxury. If a man got a tin of bully beef in a week, we thought he was jolly well off. A thing which a normal, healthy man could have consumed in one day.
Mm-hmm.
But then when we got in supplies like that, they had to be just rationed out, you know, spread out that everybody got a share.
Mm. Supplies must have been very variable at various different parts of the front, because I've spoken to certain individuals who have said that, you know, bully beef was a regular part of their diet, that it was available on a daily basis.
What was
bully beef? Bully beef and McConachie.
Yes, well, they were mighty lucky.
Mm.
In the trenches, it was just a delicacy to get. And McConachie, which was the sort of Irish stew in tins, it was a tremendous luxury. To get a tin of McConachie amongst about 6 people was absolutely glorious.
I wonder whether you found that there were some formations that had better supplies than your own unit enjoyed.
No, I never heard of that.
Mm.
No, I think we're all. I think the distribution at the lower headquarters, the distribution to the various units was very good.
Mm. Another variety of job you had was salvage work. Well, why was that initiated?
Well, there was so much material. There was a shortage of metal at home, you see. At home here, they were taking down all the railings off. For instance, all the railings in front of my house here were just torn down without any by your leave or anything to be melted in for making ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they wanted all the ammunition, all the metal that they could get possibly back from the front, you see, particularly cartridge cases and shell cases, anything that was easily transportable. And it was a question of gathering those in. And the same thing with rifles. They were discarded. Well, they could be done up and put into serviceable condition.
How did you personally organise your salvage methods?
Well, I made a list of a sort of price list, and it said distributed this to the 4 battalions in my brigade, and said, now look here, for every rifle you'll be credited with £2, for a shell case 6p, for ammunition, it was about tuppence a dozen or something like that, you see, for spent cartridge cases. And just made up a sort of salvage price list. And then if they sent in a return that they had 100 shell cases, well, they were credited with 100 shell cases, you see. And that mounted up enormously. 1 month, the 6 gardens, I forget, they had about £6,000 worth of salvage collected in the little area that we were billeted in, you see, by just combing over the ground and picking up everything that was, like the Wombles nowadays, picked up everything that was lying, you see, that was of any use.
And I suppose your priceless method enabled people to put a real value on what they were collecting.
Yes, it was an encouragement, you see. If you could get a full case of SAA ammunition, that was worth about £5, you see, if it was unused. Of course, it put up their stock enormously. My idea was to run a thing and then have a sort of prize giving at the end, but we never got to the prize giving. The whole thing sort of, the war petered out. And
this was towards the end of the war.
Yes. Mm.
Yes. Now, you also had responsibility for obtaining reinforcements to the formation you were working to.
Yes. Well, that had to be done through divisional headquarters to begin with, and then right down to the base camp. When we heard of any of our own officers coming back who had been home on sick leave to the base camp, we applied for them to be transferred to us right away.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they were simply sent anywhere that reinforcements were required. We tried to keep our own people all together.
That was, again, the family atmosphere of the territory.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Holding on. And it was extraordinary how we used to hear that so-and-so, oh, do you hear that so-and-so has arrived at Etape, you see? And immediately we would get on to headquarters and say, well, Captain so-and-so is at Etape, we want him sent up at once, we're needing a company commander, you see? And up he came.
Mm-hmm. One thing which we talked about briefly last time I visited you was troop movements, which is another job you had to organise. In fact, how did you organise that? What were the main methods of troop transfer?
Well, if it was a reasonable distance, we'd just to go by route march the way. If it was a long distance, considerable distance, we sometimes got motor transport, but motor transport was very scarce. And then if it was a long journey, we got a rail journey. When we went down to the Champagne area and the breakthrough in 1918, it was a long rail journey down to Epernay.
Mm-hmm.
And
what were the rail transports like?
Oh, the usual horse trucks. It was French railways, you see. And very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And we just sort of dodged along in those. Mm-hmm. But they got us there. The unfortunate thing was when we had that German breakthrough, they were making for Paris at the time, you see, and they got practically to the outskirts of Epernay, where all the champagne was stored. And we were rushed down by rail and were marched from Epernay to a little village called Avis, which was just a champagne cellar place. Cellars full of champagne, and were kept there to meet the Germans, who were on the other side of this wood, and we had to go and sort of keep them back. And we were away. Our transport with all our food supplies was to come on by road. Well, this is about 200 miles. And it was about 2 or 3 weeks before they made up with us. Meantime, we had no rations. The French people down there couldn't give us anything, and we had to live on the land. So the trouble was the troops just went out and picked up any sheep or chickens or anything they could get a hold of, and champagne. At that time, the champagne manufacturers had their long cellars, which were absolutely stacked full of bottles of champagne. But every worker got a bottle of champagne every week to drink as a preventative for cancer. It was supposed to be the best preventative working in those underground cellars. The damp, humid atmosphere evidently encouraged cancer growth. And it was considered that this perquisite was enough to counteract that. But the workers, they didn't drink the champagne. They took it home with them and stacked up their tool sheds and all the little places at the back. And of course, when the troops were there, they just went in and helped themselves. And we lived on champagne practically for 3 weeks, the whole division.
Any problems with drunkenness?
No, none at all. Got quite heartened. Mm. The funny thing was, we got word to clear out, to leave there, and we were drawn. The trains were drawn up in the siding, and alongside the train, my brigade was in, was a train load of trucks of solid champagne. It was all Veuve Clicquot, and it was being transported from Epernay to safer quarters. And we were in this siding overnight, and the troop train moved off in the morning. And then when they moved off the champagne transport, they discovered that all the trucks were empty. Our troops had gone in and lifted the, although they were all locked up, they lifted the floorboards and got in and took the cases of champagne. You know, we had champagne in our mess for the rest of the war. And there was a claim for about 2 million francs followed us up till the end of the war, and then it was forgotten. For the champagne, it really was stolen. But we had to help ourselves.
When you were working with 154 Brigade, where was Brigade headquarters?
Well, usually just in the support company headquarters, just behind the line, in a dugout, just probably 300 or 400 yards from the front line.
But I meant exactly where, what part of the front?
If we were holding a section, say, 800 yards, the brigade headquarters would be practically in the middle, at the back of that, about 400 yards behind there.
Yeah. I wondered whether the brigade, while you were with it, was working in one particular area of the front.
No.
You were moving around quite a lot.
Oh, we moved, yes.
Yes. When you moved in April 1918 to 152 Brigade, did you have any particular base? Or were you moving around a lot then as well?
Moving far more. You see, the whole of the 152 Brigade headquarters were captured. The brigadier, brigade major, staff captain, and the whole of the staff and all their mess furniture, everything, all their records, they were all taken prisoner.
And this was how it was you came to be transferred?
And I was sent for from divisional headquarters. Said, look here, we're in an awful mess with 152. There's not an officer left. There's nobody left at brigade headquarters. Will you carry on there? So I went there to carry on, and I carried on as staff captain, brigade major, brigade commander, until there was a new brigadier appointed, and then we got a brigade major, and then I was resolved then to be the staff captain of the 152, and I finished up the war as such.
Well, presumably because when you moved to 152 brigade, it was at a time when they'd lost their staff completely, you had to really take on a good deal more responsibility than would normally have been the case.
Oh, yes.
For someone at your rank.
Because it was practically... I went there. There wasn't a cup and saucer. There was nothing in the in the brigade headquarters mess. You see. There was nothing left at all.
Tell me how this affected the kind of jobs you actually did. How did they differ from the sort of work you'd been doing with 154 Brigade?
Well, far more responsibility. I mean, everything sort of... Everybody would come rushing to me, oh, look here, we need horses, we need transport, we need this, that, and the next thing, and food, and we need to get a quartermaster sergeant for someplace and to scrape up troops for them.
What about receiving operational orders from division? Would you have to... consider orders on behalf of the brigade?
Oh, yes, I had to take the orders at that time. And we were moved about at that time, you see. The 152 Brigade was just skeleton because they'd been pretty well... Although the headquarters were wiped out, some of the units were left all right, but the units had to be looked after and kept going as the battalions.
You told me that part of your job was to actually evaluate divisional orders. Did you ever find it necessary to query any?
No.
You didn't?
No. No. Mm-hmm. I must say the Highland Division staff were above reproach. We had an excellent brigade major, GSO1, and the GSO2 was a fellow that looked after all promotions, courts martial and all that sort of thing. He was absolutely magnificent.
Now, it was while you were with 152 Brigade that you had a visit from the Prince of Wales.
Yes.
How did you come to meet him and what happened?
Well, it was a place called Toon St. Martin near Ewe, and the brigade headquarters were there. And this morning I was sitting in a sort of ruined wee shelter place making out a casualty report to get some reinforcements up, and I heard a knock at the door of this little hut thing, and I just yelled, "Come in." So I heard somebody shuffling in, and I carried on. I said, "Just a minute till I finish this." So I finished off what I was writing about this casualty report, and I turned round, and there were two Air Force officers standing. And I said, "Hello, have you had an accident? Are you in trouble?" And they said, one of them stepped forward and said, no, we're not in trouble, but His Royal Highness here would like to see something of the Highland Division, if that was possible. So I said, "Royal Highness?" He said, "Yes, it's Prince Albert." I said, "Oh." I said, "But look here, you're a Glasgow man." And this ADC said, "Yes." I said, "What's your name?" He said, "Greg." I said, "You're not Louis Greg, your father's a stockbroker in Glasgow." He said, "Yes." I said, "Oh, you're all right there." I said, "I want to know who you are." So Prince Albert burst out laughing there. He says, "You're found out now, Louis, you see." And so I said, "Well..."